Our guest today is author David Weaver. David Weaver brought to my attention the fact that this is the 75th anniversary of Porgy and Bess, the great American opera, and the story of how George Gershwin handpicked Ruby Elsie, an unknown black soprano, to sing the role of Serena. He's with us today to tell us the background of this wonderful story. Welcome, David, to Crossover.
Thank you, Jill. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, am I right? It's the 75th anniversary of the production of Porgy and Bess?
75th anniversary. The world premiere was September 30th, 1935 in Boston.
And there's so much to talk about as far as that production was concerned and, of course, the state of our country and the world. But how did you get around to this? I mean, what was the reason that you wrote this book?
Well, Black Diva of the 30s, The Life of Ruby Elsie, which is the title of my book. Ruby Elsie was the original Serena in that debut production of Porgy and Bess. George Gershwin handpicked her, and she, of course, introduced the aria My Man's Gone Now, which is one of the most, probably the most difficult piece of music in it. So we're very fortunate to have several recordings of Ruby Elsie singing that, even though she never recorded it commercially. But how I got interested in her story was I was actually working in public broadcasting in Columbus, Ohio. And one of the women who was a volunteer for me found out that I had studied music, studied voice, sang in opera, was a classmate of Kathleen Battles at the Cincinnati Conservatory of Music. And that's when she said, have you ever heard of a singer named Ruby Elsie? And I said, well, no, I haven't. She said, well, she was the original Serena in Gershwin's Porgy and Bess and was a classmate of mine at Ohio State. Well, I had also attended Ohio State, had no idea that someone had been involved in the original Porgy and Bess. So that little bit of have you ever heard of a singer named Ruby Elsie kind of piqued my interest. And as it happened, that was 1998, which was the 100th anniversary of George Gershwin's birth. And there was a lot of material coming out that year, some of it for the very first time on CD, one of those recordings being the Gershwin Memorial Concert at Hollywood Bowl 2 months after he passed away. And along with a host of other people like Jose Iturbe and Al Jolson and Fred Astaire, the three original stars that Gershwin had picked for Porgy and Bess, Anne Brown, Todd Duncan, and Ruby Elsie, came out and sang as the closing segment, selections from Porgy and Bess. I got that recording. I heard Ruby singing My Man's Gone, and I thought, my goodness, what a fantastic voice. And that's what really started me off.
Well, but how, I mean, had you written before?
Well, I had written a number of magazine articles and shorter pieces, but I had never written a book. So this was and is my first and only book. It just really seized me. The subject seized me, and I spent 4 years of research and a year of writing. I was published by the first publisher I went to, and somebody said, Dave, you defied the odds. Your first book.
That's absolutely true.
Published by your first publisher. And I could only say, I guess Ruby Elsie's story was meant to be, and somehow, you know, was chosen to tell
yes,
that story.
But the whole thing, I mean, you are essentially a singer. You studied voice. Did you want to have a career as a singer?
Yes. I originally had planned that I would be the next Robert Merrill. He was my idol.
oh, yes. What a wonderful
Well,
wonderful.
Actually, you and I, of course, first became acquainted because of my love of Mario Lanza, and we got acquainted for that in the wonderful concert that took place
yes.
last April with Peter Nero. And the Philly Pops, and but my voice, not being a tenor but being a baritone, so I gravitated as my voice changed to singers, and I loved Robert Merrill. I wanted to be very much an opera singer in that mode, but it just didn't turn out to be. First of all, I went and tried living in the big city, and I really wasn't comfortable there. I loved Columbus, Ohio. I'm from the Midwest, and I went back there. So I started to do other things. As it so happened, that was the time when Columbus was starting an opera company. So I got involved with that. I sang the role of Sharone in the debut production of Opera Columbus of Tosca. I sang with Beverly Sills, with Roberta mm-hmm. Peters. I did a role in The Consul, which was directed by Giancarlo Minotti.
Oh, my.
So I sang in a production or presentation of Brahms' Requiem that was conducted by Thomas Schipper. So I really did
well,
some wonderful things.
Yes, you certainly did. And at the top of the heap, I would
yes.
say.
Yes. Yeah. So I was very fortunate. But again, since I decided to stay in Columbus, Ohio, well, you can't make a full-time living as an opera singer in Columbus. So I started a light opera company and produced Gilbert and Sullivan operettas every summer for 15 years.
How wonderful.
And so I really have had wonderful opportunities. I've done more than 24 roles professionally in opera. The most recent I've done with Opera Columbus, I played Baron Zeta in Lear's The Merry Widow two seasons ago. So,
So and you also have a program that you do, isn't there? An actual performance program that you do?
Yes, yes. I have done a lot of concerts over the years, presentations and programs. I actually produced a program around Ruby Elsie. When my book first came out, I created a program called Ruby Elsie and Porgy and Bess American Classics. And it kind of like interwove the stories of Ruby Elsie and George Gershwin and how these two, you know, this daughter of Jim Crow South and this son of Russian immigrant Jews and how
exactly.
their paths converged in this incredible work of Porgy and Bess.
I'm so impressed with your book. And you spoke with a lot of people, and you also read a lot of letters, you
yes.
told me.
Yes.
And Ruby wrote a lot, didn't
yes.
she, in those years?
I was very fortunate that at the time when I was first getting interested in Ruby Elsie, I thought, well, I wonder if I can find any of the, like, she was discovered by an OSU and Ohio State University professor named Dr., you know, C.C. McCracken at a little school for blacks in Mississippi in 1927. I thought if I could just find somebody related, you know, to him. Ruby, I knew, had family. I mean, she had been married twice but never had any children, but I thought, I wonder if there are any relatives still in Mississippi. And I actually got the name of, I couldn't find any Elsies, but I found that her maiden name, that her mother's maiden name was Kemp. And mm-hmm. I thought, well, I wonder if there are any Kemps in Mississippi. And I got, thank goodness for Google. I mean, a lot of what I could do, we have to say, thank goodness for the internet. It has made researching
yeah.
things so.
Certainly. Well, the whole world is at your fingertips.
And so I called this woman by the name of Gertrude Kemp, and I said, you know, my name's David Weaver. I'm Columbus, Ohio. And I'm doing research on somebody that might be related to you named Ruby Elsie. And she said, yes, she's a cousin by marriage. And I said, well, I'm trying to find out some information. I asked her a few questions, and she said, well, you know what? You really should talk to Ruby's sisters. And I went,
oh, my goodness.
It's just
isn't
like, and I felt this rush.
Wonderful.
And I thought, of course, since Ruby had died in 1943, I was assuming that all of her family was gone. Her two sisters were both in their late 80s, early 90s, still living together in
Incredible.
Columbus, Mississippi. I called them, went down, visited with them. They recorded 2 days of recollections for me. And that was wonderful because the following year, one of them died. And a few years later, the other one died. And it was like, wow, I got to that story just in time, you know, to talk to them. It's interesting because you're going to play some recordings. Ruby only made one commercial recording in her lifetime, but she'd done a lot of radio. And I'd gotten some of those from the Library of Congress and put on a cassette, not even a CD at that point. And, I played down the one sister had already passed away, and Amanda, her other sister, was there, and I started to play this cassette of Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child. And she started to cry,
yes.
and she got up from the table, and her caretaker, the woman who lived with her and was helping, you know, take care of her, said, turn it off, it's upsetting Amanda. And Amanda said, no, let it play. She said, you just have to remember, I haven't heard my sister's voice in 60 years.
Oh, my, how moving.
So it's like I was so grateful because I was able to bring it back, you know, for her thinking that it was lost.
What you're doing is you're showing, I guess, in a way, people are aware. People of a certain age are aware of what was before the civil rights.
Yes.
But the younger generation, I just think their whole mentality is very, very different. I'm talking about the younger black generation
yes.
as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that what happens is you are showing something, but the way you have written this, it's not, you're just kind of stating facts,
yes.
which I think are, it's very important not to have mm-hmm. an opinion about it,
yes.
if you know what I mean. And I think that's what I liked very much. You were telling the story as it is. And you were telling the story as it happened and what mm-hmm. she did within the confines of what was going on
yes.
in society at that time. And, of course, she had a marvelous voice. But, you know, that never really helped mm-hmm. a lot of people, you know, if they had great talent because
no.
there was discrimination. There still is, of course. But the whole world has changed. So I think this is a very important book in that
yes.
sense.
Well, thank you. And, of course, I mean, she did touch that time. She was born, you know, in probably... I was said if you were a black person, probably the state of Mississippi and
you couldn't be in a worse
early
place,
part of the century,
right?
you could
yeah.
not be in a worse
right.
place, you know. And you know, abandoned by her father, you know, at the age of five and everything. But her mother was this woman of tremendous faith.
Who was an amazing woman.
Yes. And there is a dormitory named for her at Rust College down because of her service and all of the things, you know, what she did, you know, in her life. The whole family was remarkable. The two other sisters, there is a high school named for Amanda in Greenwood, Mississippi, on a street named for her. And it's like, we're talking exceptional women, all of whom had advanced degrees at a time when very few white Americans
had advanced degrees,
a college degree or even maybe a high school education.
And you're not beating any drum or waving any flag. You're just saying these are people that grew up, they had a certain inherent talent and they had the drive, but they weren't even crusaders. Mm-hmm. They just did what they felt they wanted to do and they could make it. And I think that's what's so important because they weren't feeling sorry for themselves.
No.
And that's what you get across. I like that because this is the way it was. That's the way it was. This is what we did. This is where we wound up. And I think that's a very, very important
message.
And when
you talk about, you know, her life, because it touched on, I mean, she arrived in New York City, you know, I mean, after this gentleman, Dr. McCracken, took her to Ohio State and she graduated with honors. She wanted to go on to graduate school. I have to say one place that wouldn't even audition or consider was Curtis Institute of Music.
Well.
So, and that's the way it was. But they also didn't take Marian Anderson. So.
Yes.
And who was right from here in Philadelphia. So, but the Rosenwald Foundation, which of course funded many great singers, including Marian Anderson, Paul Robeson, Dr. McCracken talked to the president of the fund and told about Ruby's story and what she'd accomplished at Ohio State. And sight and seen, not even hearing her, said, we'll give her $1,200 to go either study in Europe or to study at a school here. Well, Juilliard took her.
And they took her, yeah.
And she got two advanced degrees there.
Now, what year was that?
1930 was when she entered. So she got, you know, her first degree in 1932. And then she got her artist diploma in 1934.
Now, was it the Institute of Musical Art then, or was it the Juilliard School?
It was still at that point.
It was still the Institute of Musical Art.
Yeah. People called it Juilliard, but that didn't become its official name until after the war. But back then it was IOMA,
the Institute of Musical Art, Uptown. I mean, right there in the 120s.
And she was a great favorite of the faculty, Lucia Denham, who was her voice teacher, who was also the voice teacher of one of Ruby's classmates, was Anne Brown, who also then, of course, so you think of, here was Juilliard, and this one voice teacher, her two prize pupils became the stars of The Greatest American. Let's be honest, it's the greatest American opera ever produced.
An interesting item about Porgy and Bess was that Philadelphia was actually the first tour stop for the original production, which opened January 27th, 1936 at the Forest Theater, just 1 week after the show closed on Broadway. Philly was one of only seven cities. The others were Boston, New York, Pittsburgh, Chicago, Detroit, and Washington, D.C., that saw the original production of Porgy and Bess as conceived by George Gershwin. The show returned to the Forest Theater in the spring of 1943, again with Ruby as Serena, only this time it was the shortened version produced by Cheryl Crawford, and it didn't have the recitatives, which of course are the operatic intros to arias. And I guess they're not really intros. They are, in many cases, a kind of a dialogue that goes on before the aria is sung. There's a lot to be said about Porgy and Bess because it is really an opera, and what we know about it is basically an edited version. However, I did see a performance, it's about 2 or 3 years ago, they had here in Philadelphia. It was a traveling troupe, and it was the full opera, and I must admit to you, I felt it was very long. So maybe we're conditioned to seeing the productions of Porgy and Bess, and we know there are so many highlights, the arias, but all the recitatives and everything, it just was endless. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a Canadian company, if I'm not mistaken, that did it. But in any case, it's one of the greatest, and actually the greatest American opera, of course. And I think you've captured the essence of everything that went on. Of course, you gloss over, but it's still very interesting, the whole Harlem Renaissance group, and then of course the Hollywood bunch.
Yes,
very, very big Hollywood bunch of black performers, very limited in the roles that they could take, but very, mm-hmm. very successful monetarily as well.
Yes. The famous statement of Hattie McDaniel, who was one of Ruby Elsie's friends.
Yeah, from Gone with the Wind.
Yeah. Hattie once said, "I'd rather play a maid in the movies for $700 a week than be one for five."
I agree. That's that attitude, which was so wonderful. Mm-hmm. Very, very down to earth.
As Clarence Muse, who is in my book, you know, Clarence Muse is probably a name that's known to a lot of people. But he made more than 400 films. His last film, you know, at the age of 90 in 1979 was The Black Stallion with Mickey Rooney. But he had a theater troupe. He was part of the Lafayette Players, you know, in Harlem. He said, you know, we do the best we can. We're professionals. We play the roles as best as we can. He said, you know, no one's asking. He made the comment when the NAACP was critical of Hattie McDaniel, people like that. He said, why aren't there, you know, black entrepreneurs who are filming production companies? I mean, Oscar Michaud was one of the few people who was trying to do that. For people that know that, he was one of probably the preeminent producer director. But he said mostly what we were, you know, we were playing parts, you know, that we were given to play. So we played them as intelligently and as well as we could.
Well, you do it the best way. And it doesn't matter. You make the role.
I have to tell you, too, because one of the things somebody asked me, well, since you came out, because Black Diva of the 30s came out in 2004, have you found other new things? And I said, actually, you know, and some amazing things that I wish I had known. There was a book that came out subsequently called Swing into the Ether Waves. And it was about blacks in radio, African-Americans. Mm-hmm. And I found so many. The Hearst Radio Network, William Randolph Hearst Radio Network, profiled Ruby Elsie on a coast-to-coast program called Lady of the Day.
Oh, my.
And she hosted her own program in Los Angeles called Southern Serenade. And I found an entry February 4th, 1939. Ruby Elsie's guest today is actress Hattie McDaniel, who's going to talk about her role in the new film, Gone with the Wind.
Oh, but no one ever forgot her.
And I thought, wow, if I could just find that tape.
Well, I think there's much more to come. You're going to have to do a subsequent book. David, of course, as you can hear when we speak, is so enthusiastic, and he appreciates everything that he's doing, and he looks for it, and he makes it turn into gold. And I can't tell you how delighted we are to have had you here today. Perhaps you'll return with the next project
Thank you, Jill.
And once again, the book is Black Diva of the 30s, The Life of Ruby Elsie, David E. Weaver. There's also a companion disc, which is a marvelous
Ruby
collection.
Elsie in Song, Rare Recordings, 1935 to 1942. As I mentioned, she only did one commercial recording in her lifetime.
And that is available?
Yes, it is available. And it's on the Cambria label. Our good friend Lance Bowling put this together, who has done many wonderful archival recordings that, quite frankly, would never have seen the light of day if it had not been for his efforts. But this, because of the fact she did so much radio, the Library of Congress, the Recorded Sound Division, helped me to locate what ultimately became 20 tracks to a CD, including Bing Crosby and her together on a program, you know, to celebrate the film Birth of the Blues, which she was in with him. And it starts off with the rehearsal recording from 1935 of My Man's Gone, now 2 months before the opera ever saw the light of day on a stage. But it is introduced
George Gershwin
himself. Most people have never heard George Gershwin's voice.
Absolutely incredible. Again, David, wonderful to have you here. I hope you'll come back.
Will do.